dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is always a privilege to be able to bring to you the intelligence of one of the smartest guys I know, David Goldman. He is perhaps best known under a nom de plume as a columnist at Asia Times, writing as Spengler. He is also the author of How Civilizations Die and a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm very pleased to say. David, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Frank, it's a privilege. Thanks so much for having me.
You cover a broad waterfront, and so I'm going to tap into several of your areas of interest and expertise, David. I'd like to start with the election, it appears, of Bibi Netanyahu by virtue of what is expected to be his ability to cobble together a winning and governing coalition in parliament based on parties even to his right, arguably, in the political spectrum of Israel. Give us a sense, David, of the nature of his victory and what it might portend in terms of his governing policies.
Well, Likud did much better than people expected, had its best results since 2003, in fact, largely, I think, because Netanyahu flanked his right-wing opposition. The so-called New Right Alliance, headed by Naftali Bennett, which is to the right of Netanyahu, very much a settler and soldiers party, didn't even make it into parliament. And that's presumably because a lot of people who would have voted for Bennett and the New Right voted for Netanyahu because Netanyahu picked up their key themes, like annexing some of the settlements. So I think Netanyahu read the mood of the country exactly well. He's going to be governing largely with the strength of the two ultra-Orthodox parties and some right-wing parties. But it's really a Likud victory and a personal victory for Netanyahu because Netanyahu represents tough security policy. He's got the support of the United States. He's done brilliant diplomacy with Russia, which is an unfortunate necessity of Israeli life. So all in all, he's done a good job, and the voters of Israel have reasonably rewarded him.
So what does this mean when, I think if is no longer the issue, when President Trump rolls out the peace plan that his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and others have been beavering away at since they came to office, sometime quite possibly in the very near future?
There's always a temptation on the part of American presidents to aim for the Nobel Prize. My friend Daniel Pipes just wrote a piece warning that the peace plan may involve giving up a good deal of East Jerusalem and most of the West Bank. I think that's a very bad idea at this time. If that's indeed what the peace plan offers, the only saving grace of it is that under present circumstances, it's almost impossible that the Palestinian Authority would agree to it. Abbas will have his own constituency against it, so the thing will probably fall flat. It may be the administration feels they have to, as a matter of propriety and decency, offer a peace plan, but I doubt it will get anywhere.
Mm. I guess my biggest concern about it, David, is not so much that it gets anywhere, but that it winds up creating anew something that we have been, thanks to Donald Trump, blessed to avoid during his presidency, namely this perception in the Middle East that there's daylight between the United States and Israel. And I could just see a situation arise where, invested in this peace plan, the president feels as though Prime Minister Netanyahu may feel constrained to reject it, and that could create conditions under which people think once again that they can act against the Jewish state. And that seems to me to be something we desperately want to avoid.
These are always risks. Per your comment, Frank, After the United States moved its embassy to Jerusalem, Israel's relations with the Sunni Arab countries all improved instead of deteriorated, as the liberals said they would. They improved because once the United States says, in effect, Israel and the Jewish rule in Jerusalem are a permanent fact, the Arabs say, well, all we can do is accommodate to it. They become more reasonable.
Yeah, and this is the point. They become more intransigent or even more bellicose when they think that things are otherwise. And I just want very much to avoid that if we can. David, let me switch gears before we run out of time with you. China, you have been writing lately that it seems as though the trade deal that the president has been seeking is closer to hand. Tell us why.
The United States economy has slowed somewhat. Exactly how much is a matter of debate, we really don't know, but it's clear the administration is concerned about it. That's why the president has indicated he'd like to see the Federal Reserve cut interest rates by half a percentage point. The main reason it's slowed is because capital investment has been a disappointment. After the biggest corporate tax cut in history, we haven't seen American corporations laying out money for factories and equipment. And the main reason for that, in my view and the view of many analysts, is that with the trade war underway, there's extreme uncertainty about where you should invest, because all of our supply chains are global at this point. The American tech industry has made a great living by importing all their high-tech hardware from China and other places in Asia and concentrating on the software here. In that sense, the American tech industry is China's biggest fifth column in the United States, because they've made a bundle off it. Without correcting that, we're going to be in the position where anytime we try to pressure the Chinese, we also step on our own foot and break a toe here and there. So that's the dilemma we're in. It can't be solved except by onshoring a lot of that high-tech industry, which would be difficult and costly.
Yeah, but a national security imperative, it seems to me. And David, I'm so appreciative of you making this point, because I think it has become almost second nature to a lot of people, particularly in the capital markets and the business sector more generally, that, hey, it's all one big global marketplace, and as long as we can get, you know, low bidders wherever they may be pitching up goods and even services, we can take advantage of them, even if, as in this case, relying on supply chains in places like China can be extremely problematic.
Well, Frank, I wrote in a piece in the Wall Street Journal at the end of December that not to control your own chip and other high-tech production would be like being a 19th century military power that can't cast its own cannons. It leaves us basically defenseless. So my argument is, on national security grounds, force the supply chain back into the United States. It's going to be costly, but national security comes first, whatever it costs.
Well, that's my view. It's one of the reasons we love having you with us. David, you bring both business acumen and a clear-eyed understanding of national security. And we're very appreciative of you being a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, for those reasons as well. We'll be talking with you again next week, I'm sure. David Goldman, thank you so much for your time today. Next up, we'll speak to Colonel Dr. Lawrence Sellin. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Dr. Colonel Lawrence Sellin, United States Army Reserves, now retired. He is a man of many parts, an accomplished businessman, a very skilled scientist, of course, a combat veteran in Afghanistan and Iraq. And these days, contributing, among other outlets, to our understanding about what's going on in South Asia, most especially on platforms like the Daily Caller. And I'm very pleased to say, as a member of the new Committee on the Present Danger, China, he is the author of Restoring the Republic, Arguments for a Second American Revolution. Dr. Sellin, it is great to have you back. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Frank.
I wanted to pick your brains about several things that I know you've been writing about, thinking about, warning about for some time, but sort of give us an update. The Pakistanis have been playing a double game for a long time, both against us and sort of more generally in that part of the world, maintaining and nurturing the most dangerous elements of the sort of Sharia supremacist world, particularly in Afghanistan. Talk about how that has been dogging us in our efforts to stabilize that place and what it might mean if the Chinese are, as they seem to be, determined to supplant us in Afghanistan in the future.
Well, Frank, I think it's important for people to understand that Pakistan has never been an ally of the United States. It has always been an ally of China. So from the very beginning, we should have understood when we went into Afghanistan that Pakistan would not be a help to us because its ultimate aims were not the same as the United States. What they were looking for is not an independent, successful Afghanistan. What Pakistan was looking for is a client state. And this falls very closely to the aims of China, which is through its Belt and Road Initiative and the specific project it has with Pakistan, known as the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. It first wants to economically control South Asia and then follow that up with a military domination of South Asia because one of its main opponents in that region is India, and it wants to isolate India and then control the sea lanes of the northern Indian Ocean.
Mm-hmm. Which has enormous strategic implications, not just for India and other American interests in that region, but arguably for us as well back here. And how far advanced would you say is the Chinese-Pakistani collaboration to supplant us in Afghanistan? President Trump, of course, has made no secret of his desire to get out of there. And there are quite a number of us who feel the same way after some 17 years or so of military operations and bloodletting and losses, some of which you were very much subjected to yourself. But give us a flavor of is this an imminent problem? Is this a longer-term one? And if it is imminent, we're going to need to know what to do about it right quick.
Well, in fact, it's both, Frank. I think most Americans want to get out of Afghanistan, and I certainly agree with them. But the issue really is, you know, what do we leave behind? I mean, do we have a plan for South Asia that will fulfill United States national interests? And I'm not sure we do. We're working very hard, in fact, with Pakistan to come to an agreement about peace in Afghanistan. But the trajectory of that is it looks very much like it's going to be to the benefit of Pakistan and ultimately China. Now, this is the centerpiece for China and Pakistan in terms of controlling South Asia. As you know, the Chinese already have a naval base in Djibouti at the mouth of the Suez Canal. Pakistan then is a link between that and China's military activities in the South China Sea. In particular, they're planning a naval base on the Jiwani Peninsula, which in fact is at another strategic choke point at the mouth of the Persian Gulf, where all the oil is coming from. So this is a very serious matter, both immediate in terms of, you know, what the United States is going to do if there's a peace treaty, but in a much, much longer term, if China and Pakistan have control of South Asia and, as I said, isolate India.
Yeah. Just to be clear, the mouth of the Red Sea is, of course, what the Suez Canal flows into and through, and that gets you to the choke point at Djibouti. But let me just ask you, Lawrence Ellen, clearly one of the features of what Pakistan has been doing in Afghanistan is promoting virulently Sharia supremacist groups, the Taliban most notably, but others as well, Haqqani Network and so on, to serve as their means of controlling this proxy state if they have their way. The Chinese are increasingly at odds, as we discussed in a program earlier this week of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, with Muslims, notably their own Uyghur population, but as a result, other Muslims as well. Would the Chinese find this to be approximately as difficult a place to operate in as have the Soviets and now us as a result of this sort of friction with, shall we say, the jihadists that are much in evidence there?
Well, the answer is yes and no. And it is the big question as far as what the Chinese will do in the region. But let me begin with by saying that there's a misconception that the extremism is coming from Afghanistan. It is not. The extremism is actually coming from Pakistan. As we all know, Pakistan created the Taliban and has been using them as proxies to do what I had said earlier in terms of making Afghanistan a client state. All the talk about the Islamic State in Afghanistan, these are really Pakistanis. It's a splinter group from the Pakistani Taliban.
That's a really key point.
Well, all this extremism is actually originating in Pakistan. Now, to get back to your point, China is both against this type of Islamic extremism and working with it at the same time. As you know, the Chinese have blocked naming Masood Azhar as an international terrorist, who is the Pakistani leader of what is called Jaish-e-Mohammed, which was responsible for the recent terrorist attack which caused that conflict back in February between India and Pakistan. So on one hand, they're making deals, for example, with the Taliban. They have been negotiating with the Taliban for over a year to set up a situation where they have a tolerable relationship with the Taliban in Afghanistan, and they don't punish Pakistan for the Islamic extremism that is originating there. So they're both saying, on one hand, we want to suppress the Uyghurs in China, but we'll tolerate this type of groups in Pakistan or Afghanistan if it's to our benefit.
Yeah, not just tolerate, and as a practical matter, Lawrence Sullivan, of course, but actually work with and presumably enrich these groups for the purpose of being able to have their way in Afghanistan, I guess, and in South Asia more generally. Let me finally ask you, Lawrence, you've been giving a lot of thought to this. What you've described is a problem. I don't think there's any getting around it. Whatever we feel about Afghanistan, the prospect of the Chinese exercising dominion over South Asia and through it, Central Asia and much of the Eurasian landmass is unmistakably their ambition, is a problem for the United States and for that matter, I would argue, the rest of the world. Quickly, what would you recommend Donald Trump be doing at this moment to try to stave that off?
Well, two things. The Trump administration has to plan for the future. I mean, as I said, we all want to get out of Afghanistan and have peace there, but peace will, you know, may not happen. So we have to have a strategy in place to deal with the future. And in particular, what they can do is in terms of thwarting China, which is the most important thing, is some old traditional containment policy there, as we did with the Soviet Union. But more importantly, be prepared to leverage a bit of instability, because China, you know, could have the same problems that we have, and we don't want to make it easy for them in the future. So we might want to leverage or learn to leverage instability in the region.
Yeah, and perhaps, you know, in some cases, encourage it, actually, I guess, in terms of taking advantage of some of the fault lines, as you've described here, between states or between sectarian groups or between various subnational actors that could make a difference in terms of countering this Chinese ambition. So much more to talk with you about. Colonel Dr. Lawrence Sullen, thank you very much for your time today, the great work you're doing at the Daily Caller and elsewhere, and of course your visits with us from time to time. We look forward to our next one in the very near future. Next up, we'll talk with Mark Krikorian about the border crisis and more generally what the Trump administration must do about it. That and more straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by Mark Krikorian. He is the executive director of an organization that I have found to be absolutely indispensable in the policy debate about immigration and border security and, well, the national security more generally. It is the Center for Immigration Studies. You frequently see Mark on various media outlets fighting the good fight, helping to explain to the rest of us what's at stake when we allow our border to be insecure and fail to enforce our immigration laws, and few do it better. So it's always a delight to have him with us. Mark Krikorian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with just sort of an update as you see things now in terms of the national emergency at our border. It seems when even Jay Johnson, the former Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security under Barack Obama, acknowledges that it is a full-on crisis, that we can't, I hope, expect to see more of the sort of nonsense that we've had from the left recently in this regard. What's your sense of all of that?
Yeah, I'm afraid we are going to continue to see that kind of nonsense, that basically the obstruction and denial that it's a problem, because even though there are still some things that the administration can do to address the accelerating number of people, families especially, coming from Central America, ultimately the problem here is in Congress's lap. And the Republicans have actually attempted to plug some of these legal loopholes that are incentivizing people to come. But the Democrats basically deny that there is a problem, period. I mean, Jay Johnson, he's not a politician. I wasn't his biggest fan, obviously, when he was Obama's DHS secretary, but he is a serious man. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are not. And I think they are perfectly happy letting this continue to spin out of control.
Well, and let's discuss a little bit about the degree to which it is doing just that. Mark, frankly, my eyes have begun to glaze over at the various statistics that are trotted out to describe what's going on. But is it safe to say that by virtually every measure, what is happening now in terms of the numbers of people coming here illegally and being admitted, not just getting in illegally, but being allowed to stay through asylum processes, is creating unprecedented challenges for us?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that what we're seeing is the developing of something comparable to what Angela Merkel created in Europe back in 2015, where they got, in less than a year, 1 million people just pouring in. And the basic issue here is that because of the loopholes in our law, if you come and utter the word asylum at our border, whether at a border crossing or when you're arrested, especially if you have a kid with you, you are either immediately or within a relatively few days just let go. And, you know, you're expected to come back for a hearing. Sometimes they'll put an ankle monitor on you, but you're let go. And if you cut your ankle monitor off, nobody goes and checks. And the ICE testified, I think it was last year, that 30% of the people cut off the ankle monitors, and they're just gone. They're in the wind.
They're in the country, is the point.
But yes, they're in the United States. They're working illegally. They all have relatives here. And, you know, even if you apply for asylum, like go through the formal paperwork process, if you lose in the end, as most people do, because they do not have plausible asylum cases, they're not being persecuted by their governments, we don't go and look for them. And we don't have the capacity to look for them. There's now so many. So this really is basically an advertisement that the border is open.
And that becomes a magnet for still more people to come, obviously.
Of course it is. Of course it is, yes. And the just not to get into the weeds, but the first cut, the first person you talk to when you say, I fear being returned to my home country, it's called a credible fear interview. Is it credible? Are you just making this up? Is Donald Duck telling you to, you know, telling you this? Or, you know, are you, is there any plausible basis for this? The standard for that is so low, and it's set in statute, that the people in the USCIS, that's the part of Homeland Security that does this sort of thing, basically the asylum people, they're basically social workers, and they want to say yes, and basically they just approve everybody. And once you're in, that's the point. That's the first cut. If you get past that, you're basically home free unless you're going to go kill somebody or run drugs.
And even then, you may be home free. It's the trouble.
And it's not even just Central Americans, because we've had a I had a staff person go down to Central America, visit some of the camps that people are in there. There's a lot of Middle Easterners, a lot of Iranians, a lot of Bangladeshis. And on the northern border, across the Canadian border, you're seeing small but growing numbers of Romanian gypsies, for instance, who have also gotten the word. They're bringing a kid with them. Could be a different kid every, could be the same kid over and over again, because the Border Patrol is barred by law from fingerprinting or photographing anyone under 14. So there's no way, if they know it's the same kid over and over again. This is a scam, and it is spinning out of control.
Yeah, on both borders now. That's really alarming. And why not? If it works on the south, it can be even better on the north, where, of course, there are a lot fewer checkpoints through which to process if you choose to come over illegally.
Oh, on the Canadian border, there are places where it's just a highway guardrail with literally a do not enter sign, and you just step over the guardrail.
If that, yeah. Mark, one of the other pieces of this that I just wanted to visit with you about is there's a lot of talk now that not only is this going on, but that the mechanisms that are in place, the agencies and capabilities and institutions that are designed to protect us from precisely these kinds of problems are now at the breaking point, or maybe even have, you know, past that point. What's your assessment of that when you look at, you know, the Customs and Border Patrol folks or ICE or INS, or the rest of the alphabet soup?
I mean, it depends what you mean by, you know, breaking point. I mean, the people are still coming to work, but in the Border Patrol, they're spending an enormous amount of manpower just babysitting people. You know, handing out blankets, handing out candy bars, taking people to the hospital, sitting there at the hospital waiting while somebody is examined or treated, because a lot of people are coming ill. A lot of kids are coming with illnesses that we don't even have here anymore, basically, that have disappeared. And the drug cartels know this perfectly well. In fact, they're using this to their advantage by telling a smuggler, because the cartels control, various cartels control all the border. So they tell a smuggler, okay, you take your 200 Guatemalans, you're going to go at this point X. You drop them off, and they'll cross over, and everybody who's working that shift in the Border Patrol basically has no choice but to deal with them. Well, guess what happens 5 miles away? That's where they're running their dope across, and there is literally nobody there to stop them. And maybe it's not even just dope. Who knows what else it is?
Mark, let me pick up on something that you mentioned there a moment ago, the public health implications of all of this. It's not that some of these diseases aren't here anymore. It's that we've eliminated them through effective treatment. But what's now evidently beginning to happen, we hear about it with mumps and chickenpox, but there's a lot of worse things that are in the mix as well, as I understand it. Talk a little bit about what the magnitude of that part of this problem is. The numbers of children or adults, for that matter, who are ill and who are requiring treatment or are simply going to be, you know, a huge, as I say, public health problem.
Yeah, I mean, so far, it's diseases that don't sound that scary, but have, in fact, been eliminated. Mumps, you've got measles. There's actually measles outbreaks now, and we're pretty sure this is what it's driven by, is by these folks. You've got scabies, skin diseases and stuff, and the Border Patrol agents are often, I mean, they're all getting sick from this stuff. And, you know, there is medical, ICE does medical screening, but sometimes the Border Patrol is so overwhelmed that it can't even hand them over to ICE for medical screening. They're literally just letting them go into the street in El Paso and elsewhere. And, you know, this is, I mean, these people are coming from Central America, which makes Mexico look like Norway. You know, these are, I mean, Honduras and Guatemala are profoundly underdeveloped countries. And, you know, the potential for a public health problem, which hasn't exploded yet, but we're getting the indications of it, really is, you know, I mean, serious.
It's a present danger. Let me ask you finally, Mark Krikorian of the Center for Immigration Studies, about your take on the replacement of Kirstjen Nielsen as the Secretary of Department of Homeland Security. She presided over a lot of this crisis as it's been unfolding. It's something of an unenviable job to take on. This fellow, Kevin McAleenan, has done so on an interim basis. What are you hearing, Mark, about the likely permanent replacement and how soon we might see it?
Yes, Secretary Nielsen needed to go. I mean, she was a cybersecurity person. Her heart was never in the kind of things you need to do to get the border under control. And, you know, really, kind of her thinking always was, I'll be in this job briefly, and then I'll get a seven-figure cybersecurity job in Silicon Valley, which now she isn't going to get, that's for sure. But this she was in overhead. It was the wrong job for her. She should have been removed months ago.
Mark Krikorian, thank you for your time today, as always, and for the work that you do. I hope you'll come back to us in the very near future. In the meantime, stay well. Next up, Bill Gertz joins us. We'll talk with him about China and the threats therefrom and what we best be doing about it, among other things, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It's time for our tour Inside the Ring. That is, of course, the title of the prize-winning column at the Washington Times, authored for decades now by Bill Gertz, a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm extremely proud to say. Also, he is the senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon and a man who has contributed not only through those sorts of reportorial roles, but also through his writings of seven important best-selling books, including most recently, War and Peace in the Information Age. Through all of those things, he has contributed mightily to the national security debate and our understanding of some of the most critical challenges of our time, one of which is, of course, Communist China. And I was very pleased that Bill Gertz attended and actually participated a bit in the meeting we had of the Committee on the Present Danger China on Tuesday. And let me just say, folks, if you'd like to see it, check it out at presentdangerchina.org. Videos of all of the events and the key pieces of it, some of which Bill has reported on in his Inside the Ring column of this week. So, Bill, let's talk about that. Welcome. It's good to have you back.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
So you noted with appreciation, as did I, some of the comments of our keynoters, one of whom was Ted Cruz. Tell us a little bit about what you thought was most important about his comments.
Yeah. I reported on Ted Cruz's remarks at the committee meeting in my Inside the Ring column in the Washington Times. Basically, Cruz outlined three ways the United States needs to confront China, the first of which is pressing for transparency. This is something I've advocated for a long time, which is basically to tell the truth about China, what they're doing, their nefarious activities, whether it's massive cyber theft or human rights abuses or hegemony in the South China Sea, the takeover of the South China Sea. So he was stressing how important that is. The second was we need to build up our military strength. And he was praising the president for the largest military buildup since the Reagan years. And then the last piece was defending ourselves at home by really countering Chinese influence activities, as evidenced in the Confucius Institutes, which are on over 100 college campuses and are basically a fifth column of Chinese intelligence and influence activities through the Chinese government. And yet there hasn't been a full recognition. There's starting to be a recognition that these Confucius Institutes and related activities need to go.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, they are beginning to go, it seems, on a number of college campuses, but it should be the case on every single one of them. This is, of course, one of the areas in which we also heard from Newt Gingrich concern. He has actually suggested that there have been three real strategic victories by Communist China, Bill, and I'd just like to use one of them to segue into our next topic. He identified their seizure and effective control over the South China Sea, the empire building inroads that they've been making in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and even Europe, and the possibly irreversible ascendancy of China with respect to the global 5G wireless market. And that brings me to the question of more generally what the Chinese are doing to establish essentially very dominant positions in cyberspace. You've written up as well as the piece in the Inside the Ring about Ted Cruz, comments made by another of our guests, Congressman Chris Stewart, a member of the House Intelligence Committee. Talk about his thoughts on cyber in particular.
Yes. Congressman Stewart, who is a member of the House Intelligence Committee, was asked about whether China is exploiting the 23 million records of federal employees, including those like 19 million or 20 million that include workers involved in classified research. So they've basically are now using artificial intelligence and data mining to exploit this massive database of information that was stolen back in 2014. So 5 years later, the effects of that. This breach was one of the most damaging cyber attacks in U.S. history because of the intelligence value of that information. It's being used by the Chinese for both human intelligence gathering, that is targeting and recruitment, as well as cyber espionage, finding out information, the most personal details of people who have access to computer administration, things like that. So it's a gold mine of information. There have been calls, as Ed Timberlake, one of the committee members, stated, "Hey, we need to hack back. We need to go after that data. We need to make them pay a price, maybe damaging the PLA military hacking units that were behind that breach."
Yeah, Congressman Stewart was a little careful in commenting on all of that. I think it's it should be said, but he nonetheless did acknowledge that this was a problem. And I think that's because, as you said, Bill Gertz, that the treasure trove of information about people holding security clearances, people who may even be working undercover for the United States government as clandestine agents, for example. The, as you say, the personal information involving just enormous numbers of government employees is the kind of pay dirt that any hacker, especially an adversary hacker, would dream of getting their hands on, and the Chinese have, of course. The Chinese have also apparently been making substantial inroads into the Navy's secure systems, which has all kinds of implications, of course, for both the forces at sea and the development of weapon systems and so on. Tell us what the Secretary of the Navy's team discovered, Bill, and what it might portend.
Yes, this was a Inside the Ring column that I did last week that talked about a report that was done on Navy cybersecurity for the Secretary of the Navy. And it was really a devastating critique, talking about how the bottom line was competitors and adversaries have exploited Navy information systems, penetrated its defenses, and stolen massive amounts of national security intellectual property, including classified systems. So the Navy was really taken to task in this special report.
Well, and unfortunately, it's not the only service that that needs such a corrective. Another is the Air Force. Talk to us quickly. You had a piece in the Washington Free Beacon today, Bill Gertz, about the Air Force's role in the Space Force and how things are coming along in that regard.
Yeah, this was at a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing yesterday. The top levels of the Pentagon, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Joseph Dunford, and the acting secretary, Patrick Shanahan, were making the case for the Trump administration's creation of a new space force. And this idea has met with skepticism from both Republicans and Democrats alike, who are questioning whether the costs are needed or whether it's just another layer of bureaucracy, or how this additional money, which could be $500 million a year, will impact the need to bolster readiness, which has been damaged by 8 years of the Obama administration defense cuts. So this was a very good, healthy exchange. Dunford, the chairman, was the most assertive in stating that the Space Force, which would train and equip the Space Command, a separate unit, is needed ahead of any failures. He noted that we usually respond militarily to failures. He said this is a chance to get ahead of those failures and prepare for a future space warfare. I think one of the interesting things that Dunford noted was that they have done what they call net assessments of the space threat. That's a basically an assessment of U.S. capabilities in space and vulnerabilities, as well as adversary capabilities and vulnerabilities. And the results were dire. And all of the members and the people testifying, without revealing the details of that threat, were just basically blown away by how threatened our space systems are by both Russia and China.
This is so important. And Bill, just very quickly, I understand that Adam Smith, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, has taken a rather different view of China. Talk to us about that real quick, if you could.
Sure. He's a liberal from Washington State, and whereas many of the Democrats are joining Republicans in recognizing the China threat, Adam Smith is someone who is on record as stating that the United States can't compete with China, which is going in the opposite direction. Again, he's an advocate of the appeasement-oriented policies.
Bill, we appreciate so much all that you do. Keep up the great work and stay in touch. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Next Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.